36 x with Commander Q.
36 x with Commander Q.
36 x with Commander Q.
30. And spirit and all right.
I understand. It's Tuesday, September 7th, 1999, 8:38 Mountain Time. Mio and I are driving, I guess you'd say we're driving through the Great Salt Desert Flats. Stopped at a rest area. It's pretty dark. I haven't done any voice journal stuff since the night of the burn, which was on the 4th, so it was two solid days in which I didn't do anything. I was tired, I was burnt out. Yesterday was all about packing, so that maybe, I don't know if that's an explanation or an excuse. Probably a little bit of both, but I feel sort of riled into doing it again. I'm loading up the camera with film, and I wrote some poems today, so basically I'm getting back in the groove. Good mood. Mio has her new love that's making her very happy. Her mood has been completely ecstatic. We've driven 500 miles today, and she's been in a really good mood. Oh, I was just talking about you, Mio. Talking to the machine.
Oh, what'd you say?
I said you've been in a really good mood, and we've driven 500 miles because of your new guy. And I just loaded up my camera full of film.
I'm gonna
make phone calls. I'm gonna check
messages too. And I guess
I'm gonna call my mom real quick before it's too late. I think Kathy's in Madison's
an hour. Mm-hmm. Madison, East Coast, Central.
You wanna check?
No, it's alright either way.
Probably Central. I don't think it's East Coast.
I'm gonna call my mom for just a minute. Check messages.
Should I do that too?
What's that?
Should I do that too?
You should check messages too, yeah. And call Kathy and then you can't book out for Mondays.
Oh, there you go. Hello.
How you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Oh, that's good. It's good to be recording stuff again. It's a good feeling. Functioning. Anyway, we left yesterday evening, both pretty full of emotions about all that had gone down. I'm now in the restroom of the stop. Mio is happy with her newfound romance, and not really upset about, you know, leaving him to help break down the temple and then go home to Sunnyvale, California, where he lives, which is an hour south of San Francisco. They're both pretty tired, pretty beat, so we drove as far as Gerlach, Nevada, checked in at the Ramada in Gerlach. Ooh, foot wash. How neat. Gerlach and Ramada, and had a good night's sleep. We ate some stuff. Good cheery mood. So now here we are. Taking a picture of the foot wash against the backdrop of the Salt Lake Basin. I've been taking pictures, a few pictures today, so I'm at least on that pretty well. funny, it's nighttime, and here we are, Utah. No longer in Nevada, where Emil found true love, and I don't know. I drove for a while today. I drove for about 50 miles, so that brings my total for the trip up to 200 miles that I've driven out of 3,600. So, not that impressive, but pretty good. I remember driving downhill toward a mountain. There was a mountain in the distance, and that was pretty cool overall. And it's all pretty mellow. I'm not going to use all this on my radio show. I'm just recording it for my own pleasure. And for memory's sake, photos, writings, recordings. Yeah, just overall tired. My ears are slightly blocked, but I'm in a fairly good mood. This is where we are, Wendover Salt Flats rest area. Just past the Nevada-Utah border. On I-80, traveling east, got off at exit 10. The Great Salt Lake still lies ahead. I'd say quite a ways. We're going to camp somewhere near there. Ooh, there's information on the state park. Alright, I'm going to cut out here. But there'll definitely be more later now that this is going again. So, more later. Wednesday, September 9th? 8th. Wednesday, September 8th, 1999. 4:16 p.m. Driving along I-80 East. Some miles past Evanston, Wyoming. We stopped in Evanston, Wyoming 4 hours ago.
For lunch. Breakfast.
16 miles. 13 miles past Evanston, 16 miles in from the Utah border. We stopped in there shortly after noon because they still serve breakfast. Lottie's cafe, whatever.
Yeah. Nice.
And we ate lots of eggs and other things. And then we came out ready to hit the road again. Having decided that because the path for a while is very mountainous, we're just going to try to make it to Laramie, Wyoming, by tonight. About a total of 400 miles travel from where we started in Salt Lake City, Utah. When the car's alarm system went haywire, it wouldn't reset itself and it wouldn't shut off if the door is open. It was quite a problem. We looked at the little mechanism that with the buttons on it that turns it on, shuts it off, and speculated that it might be the battery inside. Mio walked across the street to the Flying J Travel Plaza, which there are many out in the West, and someone there popped open the little mechanism, and it turned out that it's run by a Radio Shack battery. So I then walked somewhat bravely and somewhat foolishly for half an hour to the Radio Shack in downtown Evanston, a town that fails to capture one's interest at its peak. It's basically, once you get into it, it's flat and pretty homogenous. Nobody lives there looks particularly happy, but who knows, maybe that's true of every town.
Anyway, I came back all exultant with battery. It didn't work. We called AAA. 20 minutes later, a man who runs a service station or works at a service station in Evanston, but whose home originally is Worcester, Mass., shows up. What was his name?
Carl.
Carl professed he had no knowledge of automotive security systems, but he puttered around and he and Mio eventually determined that there might be a switch to turn off the system. And between the two of them, they turned it off. And so now, several hours after pulling into Lottie's Cafe in Evanston, Wyoming, we've now left Evanston, Wyoming behind and are once again on the road. And Mio has since speculated that it wasn't the battery and the little mechanism necessarily, but just as likely, if not more so, the Plaida swirling around in the innards of the car that clogged it up and rendered it not functional anymore, or not
incapacitated.
Yeah.
Ooh. Wow.
That's pretty close to a doorless shack.
Yeah, if you take away the bigger building, the little building is a shack.
Looking down into a valley of sorts. A lot of scrub brush, some trees, and there's sort of a burnt-out building there. I mean, that thing could have been sitting there for 100 years. That's what's amazing. So anyway, the latest report is that the car is running again. The security system is shut off. Mio has vowed not to use the key to which the security system mechanism is attached for the rest of the ride. She's also vowed to have the car completely turned inside out for various little things that have popped up along the way, none of which, however, must be pointed out, have kept the car from at this moment driving 65 miles an hour heading toward Boston. As long as it keeps doing that, more or less, things can be dealt with. Things lesser than that can be dealt with. I guess that's it for now. More later. It's still Wednesday, September 8th, 1999, 7:09 p.m., driving on I-80 East. About a half mile from exit 158, Tipton Road exit, 158 miles past the Utah border. Our goal tonight is what I stated earlier, which is to reach Laramie. And since our adventures in, what was that town called?
Evanston,
Wyoming. Mio's car has run straight and true, and there's been no hassles. Oh, and we are right now passing over the Continental Divide. Elevation 6,930 feet.
There's more than one sign that says that.
Oh.
Maybe there's two sides of it, and this is one side.
Wow. I drove for about 58 miles today. That went pretty well.
Very well.
And, now, I'm going to pick up the thread of reading Robert Heinlein's Time Enough for Love novel, Time Enough for Love, picking up from about a week ago with DiCapo?
DiCapo.
A section called DiCapo, part 6. Which opens with a letter dated from Camp Funston, Kansas. Dear twins and family, surprise! Meet Corporal Ted Bronson, acting sergeant and the meanest drill master in the whole National Army of the United States. No, I have not scrambled my circuits. I temporarily lost track of a basic principle of evasive action, i.e., the best place to hide a needle is in a stack of needles, and the best place to avoid the horrors of war is in an army. Since none of you has ever seen an army, since none of you has ever seen a war or even an army, I must explain. I had foolishly planned to avoid this war by running away to South America. But South America is a place where I could not possibly pass for a native, no matter how well I spoke the language. And it is loaded with German agents who would suspect me of being an American agent and might arrange some nasty accident for old Buddy Boy, bless his innocent heart. And the girls there have beautiful flashing eyes, suspicious duenas, and fathers who love to shoot gringos up to no good, unhealthy. But if I stayed in the United States and tried to stay out of the army, one slip and I wind up behind cold stone walls eating miserable food and making little rocks out of big ones, unappealing. But in wartime, the army gets the best of everything, aside from a mild hazard of getting shot at. The latter can be avoided. How? This is not yet the era of total war, and an army offers innumerable bullet holes for a coward, me, to avoid unpleasant dangers from strangers. In this era, only a small part of an army gets shot at. An even smaller part gets hit, but I don't plan to take that risk. At this here and now, land warfare is fought in certain locations, and there are endless army jobs not in these places, where, despite a military uniform, an army man is really just a privileged civilian. I am in such a job, and probably won't move until the war is over. Someone has to take these brave, young, innocent lads fresh off the farm and turn them into something resembling soldiers. A man who can do this is so valuable that officers are reluctant to let him go. So I'm full of that old fighting spirit and won't have to fight. I teach instead, close order drill, extended drill, marksmanship and care of the rifle, bayonet, barehanded combat, field hygiene, anything. My amazing aptitude in military matters caused surprise, me being a recruit with no military experience. But how could I admit that Graham taught me to shoot 5 years after the end of this war, and that I handle these same weapons as a high school cadet 10 years from now, and that my military experience is scattered over the next 100 years, plus a little now and then for centuries more? But a rumor hints that I was once a soldat in the French Foreign Legion, a corps of one of our allies, made up of cutthroats, thieves, and escaped convicts, and famous for their go-to-hell way of fighting. Possibly a deserter from it, and almost certainly under another name. I discourage this canard by becoming surly if anyone gets inquisitive, and only occasionally make the mistake of saluting French style, palm forward, and correct it at once, but everybody knows that I parlez-vous because my knowledge of the French language had a lot to do with my change from acting corporal to real corporal assigned to instruction, and now greasing for sergeant. There are French and British officers and sergeants here to teach up trench warfare. All the French here are supposed to speak English, but the English they speak, these Kansas and Missouri plow jerkies can't understand. So in slips Lazy Lazarus as liaison. Me and one French sergeant almost add up to one good instructor. Without that French sergeant, I am a good instructor, when I am allowed to teach what I know. But only in unarmed combat am I allowed to, because unarmed hand-to-hand fighting does not change through the ages. Only the name changes, and it has only one rule. Do it first, do it fast, do it dirtiest. But take bayonet fighting. A bayonet is a knife on the end of a gun, and the two parts add up to the Roman pilum, used 2,000 years earlier and not new even then. One would expect the art of bayonet fighting in 1917 to be perfect, but it isn't. The quote-unquote book teaches parries but not counters, yet a counter is as fast as a parry, far more deceptive and fatally confusing to a man who has never heard of one. And there are other things. There was, that is, will be, a war in the 26th century Gregorian in which the use of the bayonet became a high art, and I was an unwilling participant until I managed to duck out. So one morning here on a bed, I demonstrated that I could take on and never be touched by a U.S. Army regular sergeant instructor, then a British one, and then a French one. Was I allowed to teach what I had demonstrated? No. I mean, hell no. I wasn't doing it, quote, by the book, end quote. And my, quote, smart aleck, end quote, attempt almost led almost lost me my cushy job. So I went back to doing it by the secret quote-unquote book. But this book, used at Plattsburgh where my father and yours trained, is not bad. In bayonet fighting, its emphasis is on aggressiveness, which is okay within its limits. The bayonet is a horror weapon in the hands of a man eager to close and kill. And that may be all these kids have time to learn. But I would hate to see these pink-cheeked brave lads go up against some old, tired, pessimistic 26th century mercenaries whose sole purpose is to stay alive while their opponents die. These kids can win a war. They will win this war. They did win it from when you are. But an unnecessary number are going to die. I love these kids. They are young and eager and gallant and terribly anxious to get over there and prove that one American can lick any six Germans. Not true. The ratio isn't even 1-to-1. The Germans are veterans and don't suffer from sportsmanship or any other illusions. But these green kids will keep on fighting and dying until the Germans give up. But they are so young. Laz and Laura, most of them are younger than you two, some much younger. I don't know how many have lied about their ages, but lots of them don't have to shave. Sometimes at night I'll hear one crying in his cot, homesick for his mammy. But next day he'll be trying harder and hard as ever. We don't have enough desertions to matter. These boys want to fight. I try not to think about how useless this war is. It's a matter of perspective. Minerva proved to me one night, when she was still following the profession of computer, that all here and nows are equal, and the present is simply whatever here and now one is using. But my proper here and now, where I would be if I hadn't hearkened to the wild geese, homo tertius, by that here and now, these eager puppy-like boys are long dead and the worms have eaten them. This war and its terrible aftermath are ancient history, no worry of mine. But I'm here, and it's happening now, and I feel it. These letters become more difficult to write and to send. Justin, you want detailed accounts, written on the spot, of all that I do, to add to that pack of lies you edited. Photo reduction and etching are now impossible. I am sometimes allowed to leave camp for a day, which is just long enough to get to the nearest large town, Topeka, circa 160 kilometers round trip, but always on a Sunday when businesses are closed. So I have not had a chance to work up a connection to use a laboratory in Topeka, assuming that there is one with the equipment I need. A doubtful point. I would let letters pile up in a lockbox since it does not matter when I delay mail them, but banks are never open on Sunday. So a handwritten letter, not too long and bulky, is the most I can manage. Whenever I can lay hands on nesting envelopes, also difficult now, and hope that paper and ink won't oxidize too much over the centuries. I've started a diary, one which makes no mention of Tertius, and such. This letter would get me locked up as crazy, but is simply a daily recital of events. I can mail it when it is full to Grandpa Ira Johnson to hold for me, and after the war is over and I have time and privacy, I can use it to write the sort of commentary you want, and take time to miniaturize and stabilize a long message. The problems of a time-tripping historiographer are odd and awkward. One Welton fine-grained memory cube would record all I have to say over the next 10 years, except that I would have no use for one even if I had it. The technology to use it is lacking. By the way, Ishtar, did you plant a recorder in my belly? You are a darling, dear, but sometimes a devious darling, and there is something there. It doesn't bother me, and I have never noticed, and I might never have noticed it, had not a physician noticed it the day I joined the army. He brushed the matter off, but later I conducted my own examination by touch. There is an implant there, and not what Iris says I'm full of. It might be one of those artificial organs you rejuvenators are reluctant to discuss with your children, but I suspect that it is a Welton cube with an ear hooked to it and a 10-year power supply. It's about the right size. But why did you ask me, dear, instead of sneaking up on me with a Mickey? It is not true that I always say no to a civil request. That is a canard started by Laz and Lore. Justin could have gotten Tamara to ask me, and no one has ever learned how to say no to tomorrow. But Justin will pay for this. To hear what I say and what is said in my presence, he's going to have to listen to 10 years of belly rumblings. No, darn it. Athene will filter out incidental noise and supply him with a dated and meaningful printout. There is no justice, and no privacy either. Athene, haven't I always been good to you, dear? Make Justin pay for his prank. I haven't seen my first family since I enlisted. But when I get a long enough pass, I'm going to Kansas City and visit them. My status as a hero carries privileges a civilian young bachelor cannot enjoy. The mores relax a bit in wartime, and I'll be able to spend time with them. They've been very good to me. A letter almost every day, cookies or a cake weekly. The latter I share reluctantly, the former I treasure. I wish it were as easy to get letters from my Tertius family. Basic message repeated. Rendezvous is 2 August 1926, 10 T years after drop. Last figure is 6, not 9. All my love, Corporal Ted, old buddy boy Bronson. This is a new letter. Dear Mr. Johnson, and all your family, Nancy, Carol, Brian, George, Marie, Woody, Dickie Boy, Baby Ethel, and Mrs. Smith. I cannot say how touched I am that this orphan has been adopted for the duration by the Smith family, and to hear that it is confirmed by Captain Smith. In my heart, you have all been my family since that sad and happy night you sent me off to war, loaded with presents and good wishes, and my head filled with your practical advice, and my heart close to tears. Closer to tears than I dare let anyone see. To be told by Mrs. Smith, with a sentence quoted from a letter from her husband, the captain, that I truly am adopted, well, I'm close to tears again, and non-coms are not supposed to show such weakness. I have not lived up Captain Smith. I caught the hint in your letter, but truly I did not need it. I have been soldiering long enough to realize that an enlisted man does not presume in such fashion. I'm almost as certain that the captain will not look me up for reasons I don't need to explain, as you have soldiered far more than the captain and I combined. It was most sweetly thoughtful of Mrs. Smith to suggest it, but can you make her understand that I can't look up a captain socially, and why she should not urge her husband to look up a non-com? If you can't make her understand this, possible, since the Army is a different world, perhaps this will suffice. Camp Funston is big, and no transportation for me other than Shanksmere.
Daniel X with Commander Q.
36 XUIF Commander Q.
36 X with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all right,
an hour for the round trip if I swing out my heels. Add 5 minutes with the captain when I find him, if I find him. You know our stepped-up routine. I sent you a copy. Show here that there just isn't time all day long for me to do this, but I do appreciate her kind thoughts. Please give Carol my heartiest thanks for the brownies. They're as good as her mother makes. Higher praise I cannot give. Were, I should say, as they disappeared into hollow legs, mine and others, my buddies are a greedy lot. If she wants to marry a long, lanky Kansas farm boy with a big appetite, I have one at hand who will marry her sight unseen on the basis of her brownies. This place is no longer the Mexican fire drill I described in my earlier letters. In place of stovepipes, we now have real trench mortars. The wooden guns have disappeared, and even the greenest conscripts are issued to Springfield as soon as they've mastered squads east and west and have learned to halt more or less together. But it remains hard as the mischief to teach them to...
Sorry, annoying.
What?
I tried to pass him. He's going along at an even speed, and just as I'm about to pass, he then decides he has to go much faster.
Well, he's driving one of them fucking Yukon things. He got his penis wrapped around the fucking stick shift. He has to put it somewhere, it's so long.
There we go.
Fucker.
Stick shift up his ass. Needs a little bit of speed to get the...
That's right.
proper stimulation.
That's right. You need some lube. But it remains hard as the mischief to teach them to use those rifles by the book. We have two types of recruit. Boys who have never fired a rifle, and others who boast that their pappies used to send them out to shoot breakfast and never allowed them but one shot. I prefer the first sort, even if a lad is unconsciously afraid and has to be taught not to flinch. At least he hasn't practiced his mistakes, and I can teach him what the regular army instructors taught me, and those three chevrons on my sleeves now ensure that he listens. But the country boy, who is sure he knows it all, and sometimes is indeed a good shot, won't listen. It's a chore to convince him that he is not going to do it his way, he's going to do it the army way, and he had better to learn to like it. Sometimes these know-it-all-readies get so angry that they want to fight. Me, not the Huns. They're usually boys who haven't found out that I also teach unarmed combat. I've had to accommodate a couple of them out behind the latrine after retreat. I won't box them. I have no wish to flatten my big nose against some cow-milking fist. But the idea of fighting some rough and tumble, no rules, either makes their eyes glitter, or they decide to shake hands and forget it. If they go ahead with it, it doesn't last over 2 seconds, as I don't want to get hurt. I promised to tell you where and how I learned La Savade and Jiu-Jitsu, but it's a long story, not too nice in spots, one I should not put into a letter, but wait until I have a pass that gives me time enough to visit Kansas City. But I haven't had anyone offer to fight me for at least 3 months. One of the sergeant instructors told me that he heard that the recruits call me Death Bronson. I don't mind as long as it means peace and quiet when I'm off duty. Camp Funstown continues to have just two sorts of weather, too hot and dusty, too cold and muddy. I hear that the latter is good practice for France. The Tommies here claim that the worst hazard of this war is the danger of drowning in French mud. The police among us don't really argue it, but blame the rain on artillery fire. Bad as the weather may be in France, everyone wants to get there. And the second favorite topic of conversation is when. No need to tell an old soldier the first. But I'm beginning to wonder, am I going to be stuck here doing the same things month after month while the war goes on elsewhere? What will I tell my children someday? Where did you fight the big war, Daddy? Funston, Billy. What part of France is that, Daddy? Near Topeka, Billy. Shut up and eat your oatmeal. I would have to change my name. It gets tiresome telling one bunch after another to stack arms and grab shovels. We've dug enough trenches in this prairie to reach from here to the moon. And, wow, that means Lazarus is right now in 1917 Kansas.
Yes.
And we're in 1999 Wyoming. State. Wyoming, right. State. Yeah.
Much closer to us than he is to Tarshish.
So we're west of him.
Yeah, west and north.
We're northwest of him.
Yeah.
But we're driving toward him. So we won't be passing through Kansas.
No, and we're driving away on the timeline.
Right. So we're nearing him in geography, but farther away in time.
Yes.
How intriguing.
Yes.
We've dug enough trenches in this prairie to reach from here to the moon, and I now know 4 ways to do it. The French way, the British way, the American way, and the way each new bunch of recruits does it, in which the revetments collapse. And then you want to know what difference it makes, because General Pershing, once we get there, is going to break this trench warfare stalemate and get those Huns on the run. They may be right, but I have to teach what I'm told to teach, till I'm white-haired, maybe. I am pleased indeed to hear that you are in the 7th Regiment. I know how much it means to you. But please don't discharge the 7th Missouri by calling it the Home Guards. Unless somebody gets a hammer lock on Hindenburg pretty soon, you may see a lot of action in this war. But truthfully, sir, I hope you do not. And I think Captain Smith would agree with my reasoning. Someone does have to guard the home. And I mean a specific home on Benton Boulevard. Brian Jr. isn't old enough to be a man of the family. I think Captain Smith would worry if you weren't there. But I do understand how you feel. I hear that the only way for a sergeant instructor to get off this treadmill is to lose his stripes. Would you feel ashamed of me if I went absent over leave just long enough to get busted back to corporal
then did something else to lose those chevrons too. I feel sure it would get me on the first troop train headed east. You better not read that last to the rest of the family. An honorary Smith had best find some other way. My warmest respects to you and Mrs. Smith. My love to all the youngsters, Ted Bronson Smith, and most happy to be adopted. End of that letter. Come in. Sir, Sergeant Bronson reports to Captain Smith as ordered. Pop, I wouldn't have recognized you, but darned if you don't look just as you ought to, only younger. At ease, Sergeant. Close that door, then sit down. Yes, sir. Lazarus did so, still mystified. He had not only never expected Captain Smith to get in touch with him, but he had refrained from asking for a pass long enough to let him go to Kansas City for two reasons. One, his father might be there that weekend, or two, his father might not be there that weekend. Lazarus was not sure which was worse. He had avoided both. Now a dog robber type on a motorcycle with a sidecar had suddenly picked him up with orders to report to Captain Smith, and it was not until he had done so that he knew that this Captain Smith was Captain Brian Smith.
Ah.
Sergeant, my father-in-law has told me quite a lot about you, and so has my wife. There seemed to be no answer to that, so Lazarus looked sheepish and said nothing. Captain Smith went on, "Oh, come, Sergeant, don't look embarrassed. This is man to man. My family has adopted you, so to speak, and it meets with my heartiest approval. In fact, it fits in with something the War Department is starting, through the Red Cross and the YMCA and the churches, a program to locate every man in uniform who does not get mail regularly and see to it that he does. Get a family to adopt him for the duration, in other words. Write to him, remember his birthday, and send him little presents. What do you think of that?" "Sir, it sounds good. What the captain's family has done for me has certainly been good for my morale." "I'm pleased to hear that. How would you organize such a program? Speak up. Don't be afraid to express your own ideas. Give me a desk and I'll make a career of it, Pop." "Sir, the problem breaks down into three parts. Two of preparation, one of execution. First, locate the men. Second, at the same time, locate families willing to help. Third, bring them together. The first has to be done by the first sergeants." The top kicks are going to love this in a pig's eye. "They will have to require their company clerks to check mail against the roster before handing it out. This must be speeded up. Holding up mail call for any reason is not a good idea. But checking can't be left to platoon sergeants. They aren't set up for it and would slop it. It has to be at that point where the mail orderly delivers mail to each company clerk." Lazarus thought. "But to make this work, if the captain will pardon me, the commanding general must tell his adjutant to acquire from each company, troop, and battery commander a report of how many pieces of mail each man under his command has received that week. And a damnable invasion of privacy and the sort of multiplication of clerical work that bogs down armies. The homesick ones have homes and do get mail. The loners don't want letters. They want women and whiskey. The prairie dog pee they sell for whiskey in this dry state has made a teetotaler of me. But that should not be separate paperwork, Captain. It need only be a column of tally marks on the regular weekly report. Both company commanders and top sergeants are going to bellyache if it's too time-consuming, and the commanding general would receive reports that would be mostly products of company clerks' imaginations. The captain knows that, I feel sure." Lazarus's father gave the grin that made him look like Teddy Roosevelt. "Sergeant, you have just caused me to revise a letter I'm preparing for the general. As long as I am assigned to plans and training, no new program will add to the mountain of paperwork if I can help it. I have been trying to sweat this one down to size, and you've shown me a way to do it. Tell me, why did you turn down officer's training when it was offered to you? Or don't tell me if you don't want to, it's your business." "Pop, I'm going to have to lie to you, for I can't point out that a platoon leader has a life expectancy of around 20 minutes if he takes his platoon over the top and does it by the book. What a war." "Sir, look at it this way. Suppose I put in for it, a month to get it approved, then 3 months at Benning or Leavenworth or wherever they're sending them, then back here or Bliss or somewhere, and I'll be assigned to recruits. 6 months with them and we'll go overseas. More training behind the lines over there, from what I hear. Adds up to about a year and the war is over and I haven't been in it." You could be right. You want to go to France?" "Yes, sir." "Christ, no. Just last Sunday in KC, my father-in-law told me that would be your answer. But you may not know, Sergeant, that the billet you are in will be just as frustrating, without the compensation of bars on your shoulders. Here in plans and training, we keep track of every enlisted instructor, and the ones who don't work out, we ship out. But the ones who do work out, we hang on to like grim death. Except for one thing, his father smiled again. We have been asked, the polite word for ordered, to supply some of our best instructors for that behind-the-lines training in France you mentioned. I know you qualify. I made a point to note the weekly reports on you ever since my father-in-law told me about you. Surprising proficiency for a man with no combat time. Plus a slight tendency to be non-regulation about minor points, which, privately, I do not find a drawback. The utterly regulation soldier is a barrack soldier. Est-ce que vous parlez la langue française? Est-ce que vous parlez la langue française? Yeah, that's more or less it. Oui, mon capitaine. Eh bien, peut-être vous avez enrôlé autrefois en la Légion étrangère, n'est-ce pas? Pardon, mon capitaine? Je comprends pas.
Were you in the French Foreign Legion? I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
Well, it was, do you speak French? Yes, Captain.
Were you in the Foreign Legion?
Ah, good. Well, peut-être means, maybe. Maybe you have been enrollé autrefois. I don't know what those mean. Enrollé, maybe enroll. And then the legion. And then, is that, n'est-ce pas, it's like,
no?
No, yeah, exactly, right, yeah. And then, excuse me, Captain, I don't understand. Oh, that was fun. Short burst once every few years I can deal with looking at French. I took it for 4 straight years in high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you're doing French.
Yeah, so it's like, I look at these words and like have a vague sense of how to pronounce them, what they mean, and all that. It's funny how it's still stuck with me. It's really weird, you know. It's like strange. The funny thing is like my grades in French went downhill as I went on. I got worse and worse. I was really good in French 1 because I had this teacher named Mrs. Pepin. She was this little blonde woman. She was very cute, and I really liked her. She was very nice and very friendly. And first day of class, she taught us how to conjugate in present tense the verb to be, être. Je suis, tu es, il est, elle est, nous sommes, vous êtes, ils ont, elles ont. And it was all downhill from there. By the end, it was like just ridiculous. I was with all the fucking eggheads. Except I told you about the redhead who had the crush on me.
Yeah.
And she was in that class. Sandra. Her name was Sandra something. That's funny. The one redhead in my life has ever had a crush on me, and I wasn't interested in her. She was too tall. She was tall as I was. It was daunting. And her interest in me kind of, like, it was very aggressive. It kind of threw me. Anyway, I was already in love. Sandra, God, I can also remember her name. And she was real smart, too. I mean, she was one of those damn egghead types. They were all in that class. Like, they all sat over there. I sat, like, way there. Like, the classroom of desks was not filled. There weren't enough students to fill the classroom. So there were lots of empty desks. So, like, the other 10 or 11 students sat, like, toward the front over to the right of the class. And I sat in the back toward the left. So I was, like, several rows and several aisles back. There wasn't anyone within like 10 desks of me. It was good. I despised them all. I really did. I didn't like them. They were snotty. They were snotty. I despised them because they were snotty. They were snobs. They were eggheads with money and shit. They were like everything I wasn't, and I hated being in that class. I don't like eggheads. That's the guy with almost 2 master's degrees. It's very kind of strange, isn't it? Anyway, brief flashback. Oh, there was a girl in that class I had a real crush on, but not like an honest crush. I just wanted to fuck her. Her name is Donna Sandone. I sat behind her in homeroom. She was just this round little thing. And she wasn't nice. She wasn't nice. She was just a bitchy little thing, but she had a really hot body. I don't usually get that way anymore. I don't know why. Maybe my juices are drying up.
Wisdom.
What?
Wisdom.
I miss that kind of thing. Just utter lust. Utter lust. It's been lost in longing and philosophy. Okay, maturity. Maturity. Okay, I'm almost done with this. If I can slump through the next page and a half, then I can babble for a while. Okay. Not only I understand you if we talk three more words of it, but I'm studying hard as I expect French to be my own ticket out of this dusty place. Says, Brian, yeah. Bronson, forget that I asked that question, but I must ask one more and I will want an absolutely straight answer. Is there any possibility whatever that any French authority might be looking for you? I don't give a tinker's damn what you may have done in the past, and neither does the War Department, but we must protect our own. Lazarus barely hesitated. Pop is telling me plain as print that if I'm a deserter from the Foreign Legion, or have escaped from Devil's Island or any such, he's going to keep me out of French jurisdiction. Absolutely none, sir, he said. I'm relieved to hear it. There have been latrine rumors that Pop Johnson could neither confirm nor deny. Speaking of him, stand up a moment. Now left face, please. And about face. Bronson, I'm convinced. I don't remember my wife's Uncle Ned, but I would give long odds that you are related to my father-in-law, and his theory certainly fits, which makes us kinfolk of some sort. After the war is over, perhaps we can dig into it. And I understand that my children call you Uncle Ted, which seems close enough and suits me if it suits you. Sir, it does indeed. It's good to have a family under any assumption.
Sanyo X with Commander Q.
36 Jesuifi Commander K.
36 X with Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all right,
Sir, it does indeed. It's good to have family under any assumption. I think so. Just one more thing, and this you must forget once you go out that door. I think that a rocker for those chevrons will show up one of these days, and not long after you'll be given a short leave that you haven't requested. When that happens, don't start any continued stories. Comprenez-vous? Vous is the, it's plural for you, and it's also when you're being formal, as opposed to you, which is singular and also familiar. Mais oui, mon capitaine, certainement. I wish I could tell you that we'll be in the same outfit. Pop Johnson would like that, but I can't. In the meantime, please remember that I haven't told you anything. Captain, I've already forgotten it. Pop thinks he's doing me a favor. Thank you, sir. Not at all. Dismissed.
That's the end of that chapter. Right?
That's the end of that chapter.
It's a chapter to tell. You're there.
All right. Wow, that was tiring.
Look and, can we do one more book thing for me?
Yes.
Look and see where we can eat.
Oh, not this book, the other book.
The other book, yeah, we're at mile marker, I don't know. Again, pretty close to 200.
Very good. It's getting pretty close to 8 o'clock. 98. Wow, that was a short mile.
Oh, that must have been 197 point something. I noticed they marked the bridges with decimals.
Alright.
More of this later, bye. What are the sounds of the truck stop? I'm setting this up. We're sitting outside eating food, and there's so many trucks going by, it sounds like a good place to have sounds of the truck stop, and trucks passing the truck stop, and food being eaten.
Yeah, first she rang up the hot dog, the 2 for $9, and she realized they weren't the 2 for $9 hot dogs. And instead of going back, she went forward. Now, whether she did this out of sheer stupidity or tiredness or it just slipped her mind, or whether she didn't know how to go backward and decided that he was too tired or looked like he was tired, I don't know. That's the question you want. Well, she would assume that you would be going for the deal. That people do the deal wrong. Probably remind her of the deal wrong. These are 2 for $9. She heard you say that even though you didn't say it. But then the rest was wrong. We should get our bang for the buck out of being and get all the stuff we think we need. As I'm going, yes, we do need a bike. That's not good. Yeah, but
you
all mind listening to me right now? Oh, that's right. Right. Oh, that's right. It takes effect like an aspirin. I learned that hundreds and hundreds of miles ago, but I was going to give work to you. The work has a strange relationship with time. Being on the road, it's a strange relationship with time. I can't believe an entire day passed. I couldn't account for the events that happened today except the one Evanston. I can't remember anything. But there were lots of little things along the way. Go for it. Please. Yeah, good, good. got it left. Yes. You mean time passes?
Time passes, but defense of the animal.
How about if I can get snacks and soda out of the
restaurant?
Why just that you want to go? Oh, okay, you're just getting another one. Right. Okay.
Thursday, September 9th, 1999, 3:43 p.m. Traveling on I-80 East, just past Sidney, Nebraska. And more of Robert Heinlein, Time Enough for Love. Kansas City changed. Uniforms everywhere, posters everywhere. Uncle Sam stared out at him. I want you for the United States Army. A Red Cross nurse was shown holding a wounded man in a stretcher as if he were a baby, with the one word, give. A sign on a restaurant said, "We observe all meatless, wheatless, and sweetless days." Service flags were in many windows. He counted 5 stars on one. Saw several with gold stars. More traffic than he recalled, and streetcars were crowded. Many passengers in uniform. It seemed as if all of Camp Funston and every camp or fort within reaching distance had all been dumped into the city at once. Untrue, he knew, but the train he had dozed in most of last night had been so jammed that it seemed true. That khaki special had been almost as dirty as a cattle train, and even slower. It had sidetracked again and again in favor of freights, and once for a troop train. Lazarus arrived in Kansas City late in the morning, tired and filthy, having left camp clean and rested. But he had his battered old grip with him, and planned to correct both conditions before seeing his adopted family. Waving a $5 bill in front of the railroad station got him a taxi, but the hacky insisted on picking up 3 more passengers going south, after asking what direction Lazarus was going. The taxi cab was a Ford Lajulette like his own, but in much worse condition. The glass partition between front and back seats, the feature that made it a, quote, limousine, unquote, had been removed, and the collapsible half-top of the rear compartment appeared to have collapsed for the last time. But with 5 in it, plus baggage on knees, ventilation was welcome. The driver said, "Sergeant, you were first. Where to?" Lazarus said that he wanted to find a hotel room out south, near 31st. "You're an optimist. Hard enough to find one downtown. But we'll try. Drop these other gentlemen first, maybe?" Eventually, he wound up near 31st and Main. Permanent and transient, all rooms and apartments with bath. The driver said, "This joint costs too much, but it's this or go back downtown." "No, keep your money till we see if they can take you. You about to go overseas?" "So I hear." "So your fare is a dollar. I don't take no tips from a man about to go over. I got a boy over there. Let me talk to that clerk." 10 minutes later, Lazarus was luxuriating in the first tub bath he had had since April 6, 1917. Then he slept 3 hours. When his inner alarm woke him, he dressed in clean clothes from skin out, his best uniform, the breeches he had retailored for a smarter peg at the knee. He went down to the lobby and telephoned his family's home. Carol answered and squealed, "Oh, Mama, it's Uncle Ted." Marine's voice was serenely warm. "Where are you, Sergeant Theodore?" "Theodore, Brian Jr. wants to fetch you home." "Please tell him thanks, Mrs. Smith, but I'm in a hotel at the 31st Street car line. I'll be there before he could get here if I'm welcome." "Welcome? What a way for our adopted soldier to talk. You don't belong in a hotel. You must stay here. Brian, my husband, I mean, the captain, told us to expect you and that you were to stay with us. Did he not tell you so? Ma'am, I've seen the captain just once, 3 weeks ago. So far as I know, he doesn't know I'm on leave, Lazarus added. I don't want to put you out. Fish and tush, Sergeant Theodore. Let's have no more of that. At the beginning of the war, we changed the maid's room downstairs, my sewing room, where you play chess with Woodrow, into a guest room, so that the captain could bring a brother officer home on a weekend. Must I tell my husband that you refuse to sleep there? Marine, my love, that's putting the cat too close to the canary. I won't sleep. I'll lie awake thinking about you upstairs, surrounded by kids and Gramp. Mrs. Captain, generous hostess, ma'am, I'll be utterly delighted to sleep in your sewing room. That's better, Sergeant. For a moment, I thought Mama was going to have to spank. Brian Jr. was waiting at the Benton car stop with George as footman and with Carol and Marie in the back seat. George grabbed the grip and took charge of it. Marie shrilled, "My, doesn't Uncle Ted look pretty?" And Carol corrected her. Handsome, Marie. Soldiers look handsome and smart, not pretty. Isn't that right, Uncle Ted? Lazarus picked the smaller girl up by her elbows and kissed her cheek, set her down. Technically correct, Carol, but pretty suits me just fine, if Marie thinks I am. Quite a welcoming committee. Do I run along behind? You sit in the tonneau with the girls, Brian Jr. ruled. But look at this first, he pointed. A foot throttle. Isn't that bully? Lazarus agreed, then took a few moments to inspect the car. In better shape than he had left it, shining and clean from spokes to top and with several new items, besides the foot accelerator. A dressy radiator cap, rubber non-skids for the pedals, a tire holder on the rear with a patent leather cover for the spare tire, a rope rail in the rear compartment with a lap rope folded neatly, and, finishing touch, a cut glass bed vase with a single rose. Is the engine kept as beautifully as the rest? George opened the hood. Lazarus looked and nodded approvingly. It could take a white glove inspection. That's exactly what Grandpa gives it, Brian declared. He says if we don't take care of it, we can't use it. You do take care of it. Lazarus arrived in royal splendor, one arm around a big little girl, the other around a small little girl. Gramp was waiting on the front porch, came down the walk to meet him, and Lazarus suddenly revised his mental image. The old soldier in uniform was in uniform and seemed a foot taller and ramrod straight. Ribbons on his chest, chevrons on his sleeves, putties most carefully rolled. Campaign hat perched high and turned up slightly behind. As Lazarus turned from handing Carol out, Marie danced ahead. Having danced ahead, Gramp paused and threw Lazarus a sweeping Throckmorton salute. Welcome home, Sergeant. Lazarus returned it as flamboyantly. Thank you, Sergeant. I'm glad to be here. He added, Mr. Johnson, you didn't tell me you were a supply sergeant. Somebody has to count the socks. I agreed to take... The rest was lost to Woody's explosive arrival. Hey, Uncle Sergeant, you're going to play chess with me. Sure, sport, Lazarus agreed, his attention distracted by two other things. Mrs. Smith at the open door, and a service flag in the parlor window. Three stars. Three? Then Gramp was urging him in with something about this being a drill night, so supper would be early. Nancy kissed him openly and without glancing first for her mother's approval. Then Dickie had to be kissed, picked up and kissed, and baby Ethel walking, and at last Maureen gave him her slender hand, drew him to her, brushed his cheek with her lips. Sergeant Theodore, it is so good to have you home. Supper was a noisy, well-run circus with Gramp providing in lieu of his son-in-law, while his daughter ran things with serene dignity from the other end and did not get up once Lazarus placed her chair under her and took his seat of honor on her right. Her three oldest daughters did all that was necessary. Ethel sat in a high chair on her mother's left with George helping her. Lazarus learned that this duty rotated among the five eldest. It was a lavish meal for wartime, with hot golden cornbread replacing white bread, this being a wheatless day, and firmest discipline administered by Nancy and Brian Jr. required that every morsel accepted must be eaten, with admonitions about hungry Belgians. Lazarus did not care what he ate, but remembered to compliment the cooks, three, and tried to answer all that was said to him, nearly impossible, as Brian and George wanted to tell about their troop's drive to collect walnut shells and peach pits, and how many it took for each gas mask. And Marie had to be allowed to boast that she could knit just as well as George could, and she did not drop stitches, and how many squares it took to make a blanket, while Gramp wanted to talk shop with Lazarus and had to be stern to get a word in edgewise. Marie and Smith seemed to find it unnecessary to talk. She smiled and looked happy, but it seemed to her, seemed to Lazarus, that there was a tension under her self-control, the ages-old strain of Penelope. For me, darling? No, of course not. I wish I could tell you that Pop will come back unharmed. But how could I make you think that I'm not? You're going to have to sweat it out the way Penelope did. I'm sorry, my love. Excuse me, Carol, I missed that. I said it's perfectly horrid that you have to go back so soon, when you're just about to go over there. But it's quite a lot, Carol, in wartime. It's just that getting here and getting back eats up so much time. I'm not entitled to special privileges. I don't know that I'm about to ship out. There was silence around the table, and the older boys exchanged glances. Ira Johnson broke it by saying gently, "Sergeant, the children know what a pass in the middle of the week means. But they don't talk. They are disciplined. My son-in-law decided, wisely, I think, not to keep things from them unnecessarily. But, Grandpa, when Papa has leave, he doesn't go back next day. It's not fair." "That's because," Brian Jr. said wisely, "Papa usually rides with Captain Bozell in that big old Marmon 6, and they burn up the road. Staff Sergeant Uncle Ted, I could drive you back to camp. Then you wouldn't have to leave till late tomorrow night." "Thank you, Brian, but I don't think we'd better. If I catch the train we call the Reveille Special tomorrow evening, I'm safe even if the train is a bit late, and this is one time I'm not going to risk being over leave." "I agree with Sergeant Bronson," Grandpa added. "And that settles it, Brian. Ted can't risk being late. I see that I had better move along, too. Daughter, if I may be excused?" "Certainly, Father." "Sergeant Johnson, may I drive you to your parade ground or whatever it is?" "To the armory." "No, no, Ted. My captain picks me up and brings me home. He and I go early and stay late." "Why don't you take Maureen for a spin? She hasn't been out of the house for a week. She's getting pale." "Mrs. Smith? I'd be honored." "Well, I'll go, George," his grandfather said firmly. "The idea is to give your mother an hour free of the pressure and noise of children. Sergeant Ted promised to play chess with me." "Woody, I heard what he said. He did not set a time, and he'll be here tomorrow. And he promised to take me to Electric Park a long, long, long time ago, and he never did." "Woody, I'm sorry about that," Lazarus answered, "but the war came along before the park opened. We may have to wait until the war is over." "But you said..." "Woodrow," his mother said firmly, "stop that. This is Sergeant Theodore's leave, not yours." "And get that sulky look off your face," added his grandfather, "before we form a regimental square and have you flogged around the flagpole. Nancy, charge of quarters, dear." But the oldest girl shut up. "Father, Nancy's young man is about to reach his birthday and is not going to wait to be drafted. I think I told you so. So some of the young people are giving him a surprise party tonight." "Oh, yes, slipped my mind. Fine young man, Ted. You would approve of him. Correction, Nancy, you're off duty. Carol?" "Carol and I can take care of anything," Brian answered. "Can't we, Carol? My night to wash, Marie wipes, George's turn to put away, bedtimes by the schedules, emergency telephones on the blackboard. We know the standing orders." May I be excused too, then?" said Nancy. "Staff Sergeant Ted, you will be here tomorrow, won't you?" Lazarus went out to the curb to meet Gramps' militia captain. When he came in, Maureen had gone upstairs. He grabbed the chance to freshen up in the bath off the quantum sewing room. 15 minutes later, he was handing Mrs. Smith into the front seat of the Lodulette, himself dizzied by her wonderful fragrance. Had she managed to bathe again in 20 minutes or so? It seemed like it. She had certainly changed clothes. These wartime styles were startling. As he handed her in, Lazarus caught a glimpse not only of trim ankle, but quite a lot of shapely calf. He was shaken by the thrill it gave him. How long would this dress cycle last? While he cranked the car, he tried to quiet himself by thinking about it. Corsets disappeared right after this war, and skirts went up and up all during the torrid 20s. the jazz age. Then women's styles varied all through the century, but with a steady trend toward letting men see more and more of what they were fighting for. But social nudity, even in swimming, did not become really common until the end of the century, so he seemed to recall. Then appear in reaction the following century, a horrid time he had fled from. What would Maureen think if he tried to tell her any of it? The engine caught, he got in beside her. Where would you like to go, Mrs. Smith? Oh, out south, somewhere quiet. South it is. Lazarus glanced at the setting sun, turned on his headlights. He made a U-turn and headed south. But my name is not Mrs. Smith, Theodore, when we are alone. Thank you, Maureen. Straight out to 39th, then over to the Paseo, or Prospect, and out as far as Swope Park. Would she let him take her that far? Oh, for 1,000 miles of open road and Maureen beside me. I like the way you say my name, Theodore. Do you remember where you took the children for a picnic not long before the war started? Near the Blue River. You want to go there, Maureen? Yes, if you don't remember the way I can guide you, I suggested it for that picnic. We'll find it. It need not be that spot, but somewhere quiet and private, where you need not give your attention to driving. Hey, Maureen, my darling, you don't want us to be too private. I might shock you dreadfully. Private enough for a goodbye kiss, fine. Then let's deliver you home safe and sound. You are this century, my sweet. I'd rather have one kiss and your love and respect than entice you into more and have you think of me with regret. I decided that many months ago, you darling. I should turn here? Yes, Theodore. Brian Jr. said the new throttle he installed made it possible to drive with one hand. Yes, that's true. Then do drive with one hand. Is that plain enough, or must I be still more bold? Cautiously, he put his arm around her shoulders. She promptly reached up, took his hand, pulled it down, and pressed it to her breast, saying quietly, "We haven't time to be shy, dear Theodore. Don't be afraid to touch me." Firm, soft breast, nipple erect to his touch. She shivered and got closer to him, again pressed her hand to his, and gave a tiny moan. Lazarus said huskily, "I love you, Maureen." She answered just loud enough to be heard by him over the engine noise. "We have loved each other since the night we met. We simply could not say so." "Yes, I didn't dare tell you." You would never have told me, Theodore, so I had to be bold and let you know that I feel it, too." She added, "The turn is just ahead, I think." "I think so, too. I'll need both hands to drive that lane." "Yes," she agreed, surrendering his arm, "but only till we get there. Then I want both your arms and all your attention." "Yes." He drove in carefully, avoiding ruts until the lane widened into the level grassy spot he remembered. There he turned the car full circle in part to head it out, but primarily to see that no one else was there. His headlights picked up nothing but grass and trees. Good. Or was it good? Oh, my darling, do you know what you're doing? He switched off the lights, stopped the engine, set the handbrake. Maureen came right into his arms. Her mouth sought his, opened wide to him. For a long moment, they needed no words. Her mouth, her hands were as eager as his, and even bolder, urging him on. Presently, she chuckled happily against his lips and whispered, "Surprised? But I can't say goodbye to my warrior with bloomers on, so I took them off when I went upstairs, and my corset, too. Don't hold back, dear one. You can't harm me. I'm expecting." "What did you say?" "Theodore, must I always be the one with bold words and bold actions? I am pregnant, 7 weeks now, certain." "Oh." He added thoughtfully, "This seat is narrow. I hear that the young people sometimes take the back seat out and put it on the ground. Or do chiggers worry you?" "Audacity, darling. A warrior must be audacious. So says my father, and my husband agrees. There's a lap rug back there, too." "Maureen, my love, there is no doubt where I got my own audacity or my ruddiness from you, darling. If you let go of me, I'll get them out. I'm not afraid of chiggers, nor of the loveliest woman I've ever held in my arms. I just have trouble believing it. I'll help." She was out of the car without waiting. He slid across the seat and followed her. She opened the tonneau door and stopped. Then she said loudly and happily, "Woodrow, you're a scamp, Sergeant Theodore. See who is sleeping in the back seat." As she spoke, she fumbled behind her, trying to reach buttons of his that she had unbuttoned. Lazarus quickly took over the task. Sergeant Ted promised to take me to Electric Park. That's where we're going, darling. We're almost there. Now tell Mama. Shall we take you home and put you to bed? Or are you big enough to stay awake and go to Electric Park? Yes, sport, Lazarus agreed. Home or Electric Park? Maureen, did Graham teach you to lie, or is it genius? I not only love you, I admire you. Pershing should have you on his staff. He hastily refastened buttons at the back of her dress. Huh? Electric Park. Then settle down and we'll have you there in no time. I want to ride in front. Sport, you can ride in back to Electric Park or ride in back till we get you home and into bed. I won't drive with three in the front seat. Brian does. Let's go home, Mrs. Smith. Woody doesn't know who's driving this car. He must be quite sleepy. I am not either. I had a nap. All right, I'll ride in back to Electric Park. Mrs. Smith? We'll go to Electric Park, Sergeant Theodore. If Woodrow will lie down and try to get another nap. Woody promptly laid down. They closed him in, and Lazarus got them out of there. Once there was enough engine noise to blanket her words, she said, I must telephone back where we turned off. You'll find a drugstore further along. That's on our way to Electric Park. Right away. How much do you think he heard? I think he was asleep until I opened the door, but nothing of importance if he was not, and would understand less. Don't worry, Theodore. Audacity. Always audacity. Maureen, you should be a soldier, a general. I would rather be loved by soldiers, and I am, and it makes me wonderfully happy. Now you can drive with me with one hand again. That's just glass. He can see us. Theodore, you can touch me without putting an arm around me. I shall sit up straight and pretend to ignore whatever you find to do. But I am a very frustrated woman, and I want to be touched by you. She chuckled. Aren't we a pair of ninnies? I guess Maureen's a lusty wench, too. I suppose so, but I'm not laughing. Lazarus squeezed her thigh. I'm too frustrated. Oh, but you must laugh, Theodore. She pulled up her skirt, moved his hand around onto the bare thigh above round garters. When you have as many children as I have, you must laugh or go crazy. She pushed her skirt down over his hand. He caressed her smooth, warm skin. She eased her thighs and invited more. I guess it is funny, he admitted. Two full-grown adults outflanked by a six-year-old. Only five, Theodore, not six until November. She squeezed his hand between plump thighs, then relaxed. How well I remember. Biggest baby I've had, 8 pounds. And more trouble than all the rest put together. And always a scamp, and always my favorite, and I try never to let it show. And you must not tell on me that Woodrow is my favorite. I mean, I'm not afraid of your telling anything else. I know my reputation is safe with you. It is. I knew it, or wouldn't have plotted to take you out there. But reputation is all it is. You now know what a hussy I am under my mask. But I cultivate a good reputation most carefully. For my children, for my husband. You said plotted. Weren't you sure of it? I knew at once, when I learned how short your time is, that I had exactly one chance to get you alone and make you realize that I want you to come back with your shield, not on it. There's only one way for a woman to tell a warrior that. So I enlisted Father's help to get you away from my swarm of children. She chuckled again. But the worst scamp I have ruined my carefully plotted plans. For he has, dear one. I don't dare risk it at home. I'll always regret that we didn't succeed. And I hope you will, too. Oh, I will. I do. You put Mr. Johnson up to suggesting this ride? Won't he suspect? I'm sure he does, and disapproves. Of me, Theodore, not of you. But my reputation is as safe in his hands as it is in yours. Want to hear a side-splitting joke? One that will make us laugh so hard that we'll forget how frustrated we are? I'll laugh if you do. Did you wonder how I knew the perfect place? Because I have been there before, Theodore, for the same purpose. But that's not the joke. This is. That rascal in the back seat was conceived there, on the very spot I was going to have you place me. Lazarus thought a split second, then guffawed. You sure? Utterly certain, sir. 10 feet from where you stopped, by that biggest black walnut tree, I planned to have you place me on the same spot. I'm sentimental, Theodore. I wanted you to have me right where I conceived my favorite child, and the little imp stopped me, after I became quite excited thinking about doing it with you on the very spot. Lazarus thought a long moment, decided that he did want to know. Who was he, Maureen? What Oh, I suppose I invited that, so I shan't resent it. Theodore, I'm Scarlet, but not that Scarlet. My husband, dear. All my children are his. No possibility of error. You have seen Brian only as an officer, but in private my husband is quite playful. So much so that I never wear bloomers when I go joyriding with him. It was February 18th, a Sunday, one I'll never forget. I kept a hired girl then. Nancy was too young to leave with the younger ones, and Brian was on the road traveling and wanted me to be ready for anything when he was in town, and he had just bought his first automobile. That Sunday was one of those false spring days, and Brian decided to take me joyriding, just me. He had established a firm rule that some occasions were for all our family, some were just for Mama and Papa. A good policy in a large family, we think. So we got to that lovely picnic spot, pretty even in winter, and the ground was dry. We sat and lollygagged, and he had his hand where yours is, and he told me to take my clothes off. In February? I didn't protest. It was at least 60 and no wind, but I would in much colder weather if my husband asked me to. So I did. All but shoes and stockings, and I looked like one of those French postcards you've been by in cigar stores. I didn't feel cold, I felt grand. I like to feel naughty, and Brian encourages me to in private. He put down the back seat cushion on that spot and put a blanket on it and had me. And that's where I got when I got Woodrow. It had to be then because Brian was home just one day and that was the only time. Quite unusual, we usually squeeze in more loving. We enjoy it so. She chuckled. When we were sure, Brian teased me about the iceman and the milkman and the postman, or was it the grocery boy? I teased right back that it could have been any of them, but the woodman got there first, in the woods. Right here, dear one. I won't be but a moment. But I went in as Woody woke up. If he had slept, Lazarus had dark doubts, then reviewed it in his mind and decided that Maureen had been careful both in voice and phrasing. Lazarus bought the little boy an ice cream cone to keep him quiet and sat him at the fountain, then moved to the other end and listened to her telephone call. He wanted to know what lies he must back up. Carol? Mama, dear, have you counted our zoo lately? Stop worrying. The scamp hid in the back seat, and we didn't know it until we were almost to Electric Park. Yes, dear, Electric Park, and I'm feeling very gay. I'm going to keep Woodrow with us and not let the imp spoil our fun. Earlier than I want to. Woodrow will be sleepy too soon to suit Mama. I want to ride every ride and win at least a Cupid doll at the booths. Yes, as long as Marie is in bed on time. Make fudge for the boys. No, not fudge. We must watch the sugar ration. Make popcorn and tell them I'm sorry they were worried. Then you older ones must stay up and say goodnight to Uncle Ted. Goodnight, dear. She left the druggist with smiling dignity. She thanked the druggist with smiling dignity, took Woody's hand, and left unhurriedly. But the moment Lazarus had the car rolling, she took his right hand and restored it to warm intimacy of bare thighs. Any trouble, he asked, caressing her silken skin? None. They'd been engaged in a bloodthirsty game of flinch, and didn't miss him until it was time to put him to bed, only minutes before I called. Then they were worried, but not yet frantic. My little demon has hidden on us before. Theodore, Electric Park is an expense you did not expect. Will you put aside your pride and let me help? I would if I needed help. I don't have that sort of useless pride, but I have plenty of money, truly. If I run short, I'll tell you. Beloved darling, I've been teaching optimists not to draw to inside straits, and I wish I could spend every cent on emeralds to set off your beautiful skin, but your pride makes that possible. Theodore, not only do I love you, you are a most comfortable person to be with. Taking Woody and his mother to Electric Park turned out to be more fun than Lazarus expected. He had nothing against amusement parks and was willing to be anywhere with Maureen, except that this time he expected to put up with restless frustration in public where he must treat her as Mrs. Smith, after being in warmer privacy, then disappointed. But she taught him a lesson in how to enjoy the inevitable. He learned that Maureen could be unblushingly intimate despite people all around them and still maintain her smiling, regal public dignity. She did it by keeping her persona always intact, happy young matron with boy child clutching her hand, both enjoying an evening of innocent fun as guests of Cousin Theodore, Uncle Ted, while she found endless chances to continue her gaily bawdy conversation. Maureen did it not in whispers, but in ordinary tones pitched to reach Lazarus's ears only, or sometimes to Lazarus and Woody, but so phrased that the child would neither understand nor be interested. Once she gently chided Lazarus, "Smile, beloved man. Let your face show that you are where you want to be, doing what you want to do. There, that's better. Now hold that expression and tell me why you were looking glum." He grinned at her. "Because I'm frustrated, Marine. Because I'm not in a certain spot by a big walnut tree." She chuckled as if he had said something witty. "Alone? Heavens no. With you." "Not so vehemently, Theodore. You are not courting me. You are my cousin who is wasting part of your precious leave by treating me and my child to an evening of fun, when you had hoped that I would find you a young lady who would turn out to be not at all ladylike when you took her to a dark place near a big walnut tree. You're a good sport about it, but not so enthusiastic as to cause Mrs. Grundy to raise her eyebrow. And there comes Mrs. Grundy now. Mrs. Simpson, and Mr. Simpson, how nice to run across you. Loretta, may I present my dear cousin, Staff Sergeant Bronson, and Mr. Simpson, Theodore." Maureen added, "Or perhaps you have met at church before war was declared?" Mrs. Simpson looked him over, counted the money in his wallet, checked his underwear, inspected his shave and haircut, assigned him a barely passing perk. "You belong to our church, Mr. Johnson?" "Bronson, Loretta. Theodore Bronson, father's eldest sister's son." "Either way, Mr. Simpson," said heartily, "it's a pleasure to shake hands with one of our boys." "Where are you stationed, Sergeant?" "Camp Funston, sir. Mrs. Simpson, I was a visitor to your church. My membership is in Springfield." Marine stopped their questions by asking Lazarus to fetch Woody from the miniature railroad train just returning to its ticket booth depot. "Pull him like a cork, Theodore. 3 rides is enough." "Loretta, I didn't see you at Red Cross last week. May we count on you this week?" Lazarus returned with Woody in time for Mr. Simpson to wave and call out, "Good luck, Sergeant," as the Simpsons moved on. The trio went next to the pony ride, got Woody a straddle one. Mrs. Smith and Lazarus sat on a bench, enjoyed more very private talk while very much in the public eye. "Marine, you stole that bass beautifully." "No problem, dear one. I knew someone would see us, so I was ready. I'm pleased it was the nastiest old gossip in our church. I made sure she didn't miss us. Pillars of the church and war profiteers. I despise them. So I pulled her fangs and let's forget them. You were telling me about a certain dark spot. How was I dressed?" "Like a French postcard." "Why, Sergeant Bronson and me, a respectable woman. Or almost. Surely you don't think I would dare be that shameless." "Marine, I'm not sure what you would dare. You have startled and delighted me several times. I think you have the courage to do anything you want to do." "Possibly, Theodore, but I have limits on what I will do, no matter how much I want to." "Do you want to know my limits?" "If you want me to know, you'll tell me. If you don't, you won't." "I want you to know, beloved Theodore, I would like to strip naked this very moment. I refrain only for practical reasons, not moral ones and not shyness. I want to give you my body, let you enjoy it any way you please, while I enjoy yours. There are no limits to what I want to do with you, but only to what I will do." "First," she ticked them off, "I will not risk becoming pregnant by any man but Brian. Second, I will not knowingly risk the well-being of my husband and children." "Weren't you risking that tonight?" "Was I, Theodore?" Lazarus thought about it. Pregnancy? Not a factor. Disease? She apparently trusted him on that. "And yes, darling, you're right. I don't know why you hold that opinion of me, but you're right. What does that leave? The chance of scandal if we had been caught? How much chance? Very little. It's as safe a spot as one could wish. Cops?" Lazarus doubted that police ever checked that spot, and doubted still more strongly that a policeman in present war fever would tell a soldier in uniform more than "break it up and move on." "No, my darling, you took no risks. If I asked you to undress completely, would you have done so?" Her laugh rang like chimes. Then she answered in her controlled pitch, more private than a whisper. "I thought about that while I was taking a quick bath to make myself sweet for you, Theodore. It was a delightfully tempting idea. Brian has had me do so outdoors oftener than that once. It excites me, and he says that makes me more fun for him. But that's a risk he chooses to take, so it worries me not at all with him. But I did not think it fair to him to take that risk on my own. So I firmly resolved, with my nipples crinkled up as hard as you felt them, hard as they are now, I'm terribly excited, I resolved not to undress, but not only not to undress, but not to let you do so. Dear, will you go pay for another pony ride or fetch him if he's tired of that? Lazarus found that Woody wanted another ride. He paid and went back to the bench, found Marine staring down a lonely soldier. Lazarus touched his sleeve. On your way, Private. The soldier looked around, ready to argue, looked again and said, oh, sorry, Sergeant, no offense meant. And none taken. Better luck elsewhere. Marine said, I hate to snub a boy in a uniform, even when I must. He wasn't fresh to me, Theater. He was just exploring the chances. I must be twice his age, and was tempted to tell him so. It would have hurt his feelings. The trouble is that you look 18, so they're certain to try. Darling, I do not look 18. Me with a daughter over 17? If Nancy marries her young man before he goes to war, she wants to, and Brian and I won't stop it, I'll be a grandmother this coming year. Hi, Grandma. Tease. I will enjoy being a grandmother.
That was the turn.
What turn?
I already turned a pretty sharp turn, I remembered, in the middle of Nebraska. I kept waiting for it, but that was it.
Oh. I'm certain you will, dear. I think you have great capacity for enjoying life. As I do, Mama. And now I feel sure I got it both from you and Pop. I do, Theater, she smiled, even when frustrated, very. Me too, very. But we were talking about how old you look, 18 that is. Pooh, you notice how broken down and baby-chewed my breasts are. I notice nothing of the sort. Then you have no sense of touch, sir, for you handle them quite thoroughly. Excellent sense of touch, lovely breasts. Theater, I try to take care of them, but they've been filled with milk much of the past 18 years. That one, she nodded toward the pony ring, I didn't have enough milk for him and had to put him on Eagle brand, and he resented it. When I had Richard 2 years later, Woodrow tried to crowd out the new baby and take my freshened breasts. I had to be firm, when what I wanted to have was to have one at each breast. But one must be fair to children and not spoil one at the expense of another. She smiled indulgently. I have no sense about Woodrow, so I must follow my rules to the letter. Come back in a year, Theater, and they won't seem so broken down. But they will swell out and make me look like a cow. I think I know where another tape is. Okay. Stop this here.
36 X-Wing Commander Q.
36 X-Wing Commander Q.
36 X-Wing Commander Q. Train.
And spirit and all right.
Well, in answer to a request we've had to do a song on the Cordeen, we want to do for you a little Cordeen number, because people come in, you know, and they see the Cordeen there, and they say, hey, man, grab a hold of that thing and really do something wild with it. So we'd like to do for you this wild Cordeen song, and it's called The Wild Song of the Cordeen. Swamp Fire. Okay, folks. First of all, we want to show you how you put a Cordeen on. Hey, Cordeen, you're too much. Man, you're something else. That's called putting your Cordeen on. Hey, listen. Will you hear this? Listen. A train. 56 Chevy station wagon. Bomber. Union Pacific diesel. Shoes. Thunder. Rain. A Union Pacific diesel with a 56 Chevy station wagon. A train with shoes. A diesel with a Union Pacific station wagon and shoes in the rain and a bomber. A tight end accordion player. Our next accordion number. This is what we call an awe song. It's kind of song when you hear it, you're compelled to say aw. You watch, you can't help it. This is an awe song. It's a hey song. When you hear this one, you want to say hey. Hey, that sounds like an awe song. The next Cordeen song is a serious musical expose. Everywhere in the world today, every major city, there's an evil industry in the form of a Cordeen school. Yeah. Run by a guy who is as sinister as he is brilliant. To the children of his community, he gives Cordeen lessons, and to their parents, he sells them big Cordeens for cash. Father and son enter the studio one fine day, and the father finds the professor, and he says to him, yo, professor, about how much I gotta tie up to get the kid going on the Cordeen, huh? And the professor says, sir, your boy can start on this $10 Cordeen. And in disbelief, the father says, well, I mean, $10. I mean, you think my kid could play one like that? And the professor says, are you kidding? And he picks up the $10 Cordeen and plays. Impressed, they buy that Cordeen. And a year later, the child returns playing. Well, the father is understandably depressed. And he goes back and he says, yo, professor, I'm understandably depressed. What's wrong here? The kid don't got it or what? The professor says, I'll tell you what's wrong, my good man. Your boy is limited because of the instrument. If you were to buy him this $300 accordion, he could learn a lot faster. And the father says, 300 zords. Well, I don't know. You think the kid could play one like that? The professor says, you kidding? Picks up the accordion and plays. They buy the accordion, and a year later, that child returns playing. Father is really angry. He's so angry, he's beside himself, and he goes back and he says, yo, professor! And the professor says, who's the other guy? Looks just like you. He said, that's me, I'm beside myself. 300 hogs for the Cordeen. That kid don't got nothing. Oh, what's wrong? And the professor says, I'll tell you what's wrong. I'll tell you right out front what's wrong. Or never mind, I'll tell you in here. That boy has lost his incentive, no will to learn. Buy him this $2,000 accordion and he'll want to play. And the father says, $2,000 brogues? Man, I don't believe nobody could play one like that. And the professor picks up the accordion and plays. And the evil part here is that the only song the professor ever learned was. The professor can't even play. So the father and the kid opened the accordion school just down the street to teach professors. And they told him it's jazz and work in a church is in Boston.